Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial. Well, greetings, welcome, and how are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 181 for the beginning of October 2010. The fourth quarter, we're down to the last 3 months of the year. Hopefully you've been successful, or at least you're learning a lot throughout this year, because this year has thrown a tremendous amount of curveballs in the way of, well, currency transactions, quantitative easing. We have things of sovereign debt crises happening around the world. We have a little bit of trade spats. We have bonds going up, stocks moving sideways. We have range-bound issues. Lots to consider right now. One of the things we're going to talk about today is a question that really focuses in on the whole area of quantitative easing. We're also going to have some great guests on today. And first up is Jeff Middleswart, and he's been on before. We're going to get in touch with him and speak with him about what we call behind the numbers. He's a guy that really crunches the numbers and comes up with some of the things that you need to be concerned about, looking for, and kind of weeding through when it comes to the actual area of the underlying issues concerned with the stock. You know, is there something in their reports that's a red flag? Is there something that should be considered in terms of margins as an issue? We're going to talk with him. And then our special guest is Scott O'Neill. Scott O'Neill, we're going to speak with him and hook him in right after that. And hopefully, if the scheduling works just right, we'll get it right in there. And we're going to be talking with him about the new tool called MarketSmith. Now, you may know the name. William O'Neill, of course, William O'Neill & Company, is Investor's Business Daily, and we've had Kate Stalter on before, but this is really special because this is a tool that I think will really revolutionize the way that you research stocks. We use Investor's Business Daily a lot for their various tools just to, you know, look at a variety of different metrics. We also have Bloomberg, and we have Thomson Reuters, and we have all that good stuff. You know, some of that helps, some of that doesn't. But one of the things I really like is some of the techniques they use over there, very similar to our Quanta Funda Tecna. And they have a really nice way of showing how a stock looks and actually the fundamentals. So the chart and the fundamentals all on one page. And MarketSmith is something that I've been looking at and using. I've always used the daily graphs as well. And I think that he'll shed some light on that. Very interesting guy. Met him recently, and I think that that's going to be a great interview. I can't wait for that, actually. So let's start off with this whole idea of quantitative easing, QE2, QE1.5. What the heck is going on? We have a very interesting dynamic happening right now when it comes to the U.S. markets. We are clearly seeing a very mixed message when it comes to the actual economic numbers. We're seeing companies starting to raise their rates on things. For example, we saw Starbucks raise their coffee prices on certain select items at their stores. We saw FedEx actually increase their rates by about 3.9% last week on a variety of different services that they have. UPS followed suit, of course. And, you know, you have to wonder, at a time with this high level of unemployment, how, in fact, do we get away with something like that? How do these companies get away with increasing prices where retail has to be cutting and sustaining prices? We use the idea of the Fed coming in to do this quantitative easing. That's a nasty word. They want to call bond purchases. They're coming in and they're going to use money that's made out of thin air. So basically think about quantitative easing as money that they print. That's really the phrase you use. And they're coming in and they're talking about buying treasuries, particularly the mid to longer dated treasuries, to keep interest rates down. The Fed doesn't have the tool anymore to actually move interest rates any lower, right? Because the Fed rate and the Fed funds discount rate is really at the low that they can be. So what do? They need to start lowering down the longer term that they think so that it will spur on inflation. And in their mind, here's what happens. The idea that rates will stay low for an extended period of time will be good because that will enable individuals and companies to refinance and to maybe make purchases on credit. Well, let's not get too carried away and talk about how credit really screwed up things over the last number of years. But okay, so they think that a low rate will help. Well, credit card rates aren't going down if you can get it. And how much lower will it really need to be to entice people to buy a house at this point? Because we're seeing property prices really not even stabilized. The Case-Shiller looked a little lower, and we're seeing new home purchases and we're seeing existing home purchases in the dumps. So I'm not really convinced that the whole idea of quantitative easing for that is really that important. I don't think they're thinking that it's going to spur on buying of homes and it's going to help that recovery. Nor do I really believe that the quantitative easing issue that they're doing is really all about the employment prospects. I mean, how do you get jobs out of that? Where do the jobs come from? But I'll tell you what I think is going on right now. I think one of the things that's going on is they deliberately are doing this and they're killing the dollar. Now, they talk about it. Interestingly enough, some Fed talk came out last week and said, oh, you know, we really don't see any correlation between quantitative easing and the dollar. We don't see there's anything really going on. Well, of course there is. You're killing the dollar by printing it out of nowhere. We know this. We're not stupid. At the same time, what this does is it creates inflation. Look what happened recently. We saw agricultural prices, because of a variety of circumstances, in considering the quantitative easing, moving very much higher. Of course, last week we saw a drop in the ags because we saw much better, not in all of them, but in a couple, I think sugar and corn. Corn finished pretty bad for the week, but that's after being up dramatically. And that has to do with harvest issues. It's a little bit different. But when you look at the prices of gold at a high, oil is back above $81 a barrel. I mean, very quickly last week. Moved up very, very quickly. We're seeing the dollar move down against most major currencies, if not all major currencies. And what's happening right now is they are deliberately putting a discount on buying goods from the U.S. They're trying by congressional order to force the Chinese to raise the yuan. But if that doesn't work, they will go and forcibly move down the valuation of the U.S. dollar. Now, that doesn't help a lot of the fellows who own a good chunk of treasuries. Now, that will bring up the value of treasuries by bringing down the interest rate, because it's forcibly buying it, I should say, so it brings down the interest rate. But, you know, you get this dollar conversion issue that's very scary. And what happens is that the holdings of treasuries by foreign owners really gets no benefit out of all of this because they lose the value on the currency conversion, which is exactly what I want to get into right now. And this discussion is very, very timely. And I just got a question in. I got a few actually I gotta talk about for next week. We'll definitely answer some questions next week. And by the way, we have Tom McClellan coming on next week to talk about. I asked him specifically about his whole idea about the presidential cycles and what's that mean. I'm going to get in depth into some of his oscillators and indicators. But before we get to our guest today, I wanted to answer a question from Daniel. And he says, hey, Andrew, I hope you're doing great. Been listening to the show for a while. Would love to get some input on a quick question, please. I've been mostly short for the last little while, whole markets and financials specifically, and would likely continue to be short. However, I live in Toronto and I'm starting to get worried about devaluation of the U.S. dollar, especially if QE2 comes along. Despite that some of the ETFs I use right now are leveraged, they are still in U.S. dollar, and a lot of the gains or potential gains in the future may get offset by a weaker American dollar. I thought of switching over to some Canadian ETFs, but based on my research, the variety is so much smaller for Canadian ETFs. Nothing times three leverage like some of the Americans ETFs offer. We'd love to get your input on how to handle the situation and how do you guys protect your portfolio from devaluation of the dollar. This is a great question because it's very timely and something that we have been wrestling with right now. I can give you a basic answer to this. It's not absolute because, let me give the answer and I'll explain it. What you want to do is hedge out your currency, the currency exposure you have. Now, for those in the U.S., I'm going to talk to you in U.S. terms right now. And Daniel, you'll be able to reverse this and talk about this in Canadian dollars. Same discussion. Let's use Japan as an example. Let's say we want to buy the Japanese Nikkei ETF, EWJ. And we want to buy it because we think that, for some reason, we believe that the Japanese stocks are going higher. Okay. We did our research and we came up with this and we're buying it. Let's say we buy $10,000 worth, whatever it buys us in shares. Now, the problem is that we're buying those in real U.S. dollars. And as the markets move, so will the underlying securities inside that ETF. But at the same time, as the Japanese yen moves, so will the value of that security. So, for example, if the Nikkei moves up 2%, let's say in a week, but the yen moves down 1%, what happens is, compared to the U.S. dollar, you're going to have a net 1% gain. That's what will register on your return for the ETF. You don't have to worry about currency conversions or think about it right then and there. Or what will happen is because you bought it in dollars, that's what the value would be. Said another way, if you had the EWJ ETF and you had it for a week and there was zero return on it, but the yen moved up by, let's say, 1% during that period of time, you would get a 1% return, say plus 1% by the end of the week on that. In other words, it would just simply move up in value. Now, the problem comes in for those people that are looking at a situation, and I'll give you an exact situation that's happening to us right now. Over the last several weeks, and maybe even a month, we have been invested short, and we've added to the position continually on European equities. A couple different names that we use. We use one leverage. We use a half position on the leveraged account because those are for IRAs and for accounts that we can't actually go short. And we use an ETF to go short the European equities, okay? So now here's the problem. European equities have actually been down, let's say last week, the week before. They've been down, okay? The problem is that the euro has been going up. So the euro has been going up, but let's say, I'm just giving you a number here, 3% over the last 3 weeks, whereas stocks were down, let's say, 1%. Well, we have a net 2% loss on that right now. So the problem is that, the question that we have to ask ourselves is, do we want to actually hedge? Now, if we wanted to actually hedge it and we thought the euro was going to continue up forever or the dollar was going down forever, whatever you want to call it, and this is right to Daniel's question, what we would do is one of two things. Either we would short the dollar, we would go into an ETF that is, for example, since we're using the euro, we would find or an ETF or go into the currency market and short the dollar against the euro, or better yet, find an ETF that goes long the euro. So now we've kind of hedged out some of our currency risk. In other words, we're short the US, we're long the euro. Now, the problem with that is that, of course, anything can go in any direction. But considering what Daniel is talking about, you may want to short the US and long Canadian dollars. So you find the ETF that is Canada long USA short. And I will quickly, I don't remember what that one is, CAD or C, I will find it for you real quickly. Oh yeah, FXC, that's what it is, FXC. Now here's what happens, when you actually go into FXC, you're neutralizing your position, right? Because you're going short the dollar, but you're then again long the dollar in the ETFs that you're talking about. So what you're doing is you're neutralizing your position and you use an exact amount of dollars that you bought, or Canadian, whatever you can do. You know, there were $10,000 investment in the ETF of, we'll use Europe again, or Japan better, we'll use Japan. $10,000 in Japan ETF, and what I'll find is the inverse of that, and I'll go into the ETF, the currency, with $10,000 just to equalize my position, if you want to do that. You know, you may want to consider, do you want to have an unhedged position or a hedged position? But that will take out all the currency risk there. Now, by using a two-time, Dan, you mentioned two-times and three-time multiples. Be very careful with those for a lot of reasons. But the question is really how are those going to react on a currency basis may not be a one-to-one. So just be careful with that circumstance. You have to probably multiply that too, and that can get you in a lot of trouble. Just be careful with that. Anyway, we're going to get to our first guest and speak with him to find out really what's behind the numbers. So stick around. We're going to be right back once we get the old phones going. And it's going to be a great show, and I really appreciate you being there. Tell some friends. Leave a review on iTunes. That would be great. Leave a review on iTunes. I'd really appreciate that. It takes 2 seconds. Just go over to iTunes and leave a quick review. And, of course, all the notes and all the information about our guests and links to the various things are on thedisciplinedinvestor.com right in the show notes for this particular episode. Episode number 181. We'll be right back. And we're back with a really good friend of mine that we've had on the show before, and someone who I talk to not as often as I should probably. He is an expert when it comes to digging down deep and understanding the intricacies of not only balance sheets, cash flow analysis, but also the bigger picture. The company he works for, the piece that he writes, is called Behind the Numbers. His name is Jeff Middleswart, and I want to welcome you. How you doing, bub?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Listen, so you and I have been talking recently about the whole idea of margin squeezes, the whole idea that things are going up in price, whatever that may be, and how, and the question we've both asked is how is that going to be passed on to the end buyer? So an example would be that you see, for example, the price of steel going up. Well, how are you going to pass that on down the ranks? You see the price of corn and wheat going up. Well, are Wheaties going to be able to be priced higher? And one of the things we really focused on and what you've really been talking about is coffee. And the idea that Starbucks and a few other coffee, Green Mountain Coffee Roasters and a few others, could see problems. Tell me a little bit about the thesis behind the Starbucks coffee margin squeeze.
Oh, sure. You know, one of the big things going on is, you know, these companies, everybody looks at them and says they dominate the retail side or they've got lots of customers that want to shop there no matter what. And you know, you quickly find out that commodities, you know, trade on the world market. There's been droughts at times, or there's been too much rain in other times for coffee beans, as well as sugar. Dairy is up considerably over the last year, year and a half. So a lot of these input costs that a Starbucks or a Green Mountain use have been rising, you know, at an amazing clip. At the same time, these companies have taken down their inventories. One of the big themes that we've seen over the last, last 2 years, has been companies that have essentially slashed their working capital, run down their inventories, worked on their customers to get paid faster, and at the same point boosted their own payables to generate cash flow. Mm-hmm. And so you're at this point now is their commodity prices are rising on them. They don't have anything stored up. So you're seeing a lot more rapid increases on their income statement on cost of goods sold because the commodity prices are coming up so fast. And at the same point, you're seeing customers are very resistant to price hikes, they trade down. Mm-hmm. If they go to a Starbucks, they get a smaller cup of coffee. They get just a pure black coffee instead of a latte or something like that.
Right.
So you end up with this margin squeeze where they're getting less revenue per customer. At the same point, their unit costs are rising.
So I wrote about this actually for the upcoming quarterly that we do. We put out a piece for every one of our clients on a quarterly basis, kind of looking at some of the key drivers for what happened, but what we think economically is going to happen over the next 3 to 6 months. And one of the things that I focused on was this whole idea. It's interesting because we didn't talk about this particular thing prior, was the inventory cycle. Whereas Starbucks, as an example, since we're focusing on them, they cut their inventories because they thought they were being very smart, right? Because back in 2007, 2008 through 2009, they had excess inventory and they couldn't sell it. Now, Starbucks may not be the best example of that, more like a retailer in the clothing. They had, you know, they have to get rid of their goods. Starbucks will probably hold their coffee and sugar for a little longer. But
sure.
What happened is that the inventories that blossomed because they thought sales were going to end up being forever, they didn't see what was going to happen, ended up being a real headwind for them because they had to slash their prices, get rid of old inventory because it was no longer in style, right? And then
that's very true.
And then now they say, you know what, we're going to be a lot smarter this time around. We're going to use just-in-time inventory control as best as possible. And now they're going to get them, you know, because they don't want to ever repeat the mistake that happened last couple of years.
You got one more problem in that so much stuff has been outsourced to Asia and other developing market countries So you've built in a lot of lead time in order to make, by the time they order inventory and they actually receive it. So when you do just-in-time inventory and keep your inventory levels low, you're really operating on no margin for error, with the idea being that hopefully you can get the stuff, but as soon as it gets into your door, it's going to be at a higher price, and you don't have any other options.
Right.
You know, it's the only thing it's only you're going to get.
And now you have, cotton prices in this quarter only of 40%, wheat, beans, sugar up 30-40%. You have a variety of other commodities like coffee, I think, at a 15-year high. And, you know, we're all of a sudden faced with, in a reasonably short period of time, look at sugar as an example. Sugar was up dramatically, dropped 50%, and now went back up 50%. And you look at these things, and is there any way within a quarter's period of time with that change in pricing for the underlying input items, you know, how will, again, we're focusing on Starbucks here for no other reason because it's just the one we're looking at, can, how are they going to deal with this?
They're eventually, it's going to look like, everything's going to look like how the grocery stores have been for the last, four or five quarters. And what's happened with the grocery stores, and this is going to back up on Starbucks, it's going to back up on Kraft, it's going to back up through Sara Lee, Procter & Gamble, all these kind of companies. The grocery stores have seen huge price increases for commodity-related stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it's worked their way through their system. They can't pass that on to their customers.
Right.
Because the customers basically say, we just won't buy it. You know, we won't buy steak, we'll buy chicken. Or if the chicken's too high, we won't buy that, we'll just buy cereal. And so dairy prices have gone up about 100%. Sugar's gone up. You're seeing people just not buy this stuff as much. Or the grocery stores use it as a competitive thing where they beat each other up. So margins for grocery stores have been just decimated over the last 4 to 5 quarters. Because their costs have come up and they can't pass it through.
And they were razor thin to begin with.
They were already razor thin. Grocery stores primarily make their money simply by charging companies what are called slotting fees. They basically sell the real estate, which is their shelf space.
Right.
So if you want center aisle at eye level, you know that costs more to buy use that shelf space to put your cereal versus the bottom shelf.
Right.
And that's primarily where they get their profits, but they hope to break even to some degree on selling food.
Right.
So you've got this problem now where they're losing money selling food, and they just have no way to make that up. And I think that whole process is going to back up through the whole channel, where you're going to get the suppliers that are making branded food or selling supplies to the grocery store. They're not going to be able to get the price hikes. At the same point, the cost increases are coming through to them, and you're going to see a lot of margin squeeze coming through. You know, companies like Starbucks, McDonald's, the various restaurants, as well as all the branded food companies.
Yeah, nobody thinks about McDonald's. McDonald's has a big stake in the coffee business right now. And, of course, we look at their other import prices. You know, the beef costs have gone up dramatically. They're probably a little bit better at hedging things, particularly when it comes to their main products, like the beef, assuming that is beef, and chicken and things of that nature. But I wonder if they're how adept they are on this new coffee situation, if they really caught that one. But you know what? Just to confirm what you're saying here about the food prices and the margin squeezes, particularly in the supermarket and in the grocery, Kroger came out with an announcement that basically said word for word what you're saying, which was a piece that was their admission that they're having a very difficult time, not only with the fact that consumers are being more frugal, et cetera, but by the fact that they have a higher input cost compared to what they can pass on. Now, in most circumstances, we've been hearing that there's no inflation, but what we're really seeing is there are inflationary pressures that are building. Don't you agree?
Oh, yeah. What you're seeing is the producer price index is going up rapidly, and the consumer price index is not, because we're basically, whether they want to say we're in recession or not, most people think we are. So you're seeing weakness at the consumer price level, and that as the producer price rises faster, it's just squeezing everybody that's in the middle of it. And you know, the guys that are at the end user right before the customer is the grocery store,
right.
And so that's why they're seeing it now, and you're going to see it build a lot more quickly, you know, throughout other areas of the market. One of the companies we follow is Cracker Barrel, and you know, Cracker Barrel had raised price about a year ago, and they've already been announcing that people were trading down, that they raise price 2 or 3%, their average ticket is still flat because people, instead of getting ham and eggs, started ordering pancakes. It's people have ways to get around that. All these restaurants, like a McDonald's, coffee's been one of their big growth areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's also one of the most, the inputs for coffee are some of the fastest growing prices out there.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
They got a problem.
Right. You know, what's interesting is that a lot of things we're talking about right now are a lot of the things this piece we're writing on. I don't want to give it all away right now, but the whole idea is, you know, we look at deflation, which is what is really the big concern of the Fed and the Fed markets right now. You see our inflation, which we see, for example, in places like Brazil, maybe India, and a few other places around the world, like Australia, that are trying to keep prices down. And then there's this really nasty, horrible word called stagflation, which is the worst of both. And if you really consider what's going on, the very simple definition of stagflation, and we're going to leave it there because I'd like everybody to read what we're writing about, which will be out in about a week and a half. But basically, this whole idea is stagflation out there. Let's skip ahead, though, to a couple of other stocks that I know that you are following. So Starbucks is one we know about in terms of all the things that are going on in the area of margin squeezes, et cetera. There have been also, in fact, Green Mountain came out with an announcement that they're being, the SEC is investigating them due to some kind of recognition of income with one of their parties. But they've raised prices too. What other areas are kind of sticking out to you right now? And you know, with a red light. Now understand, everybody, that Jeff's job is to find the inconsistencies and the problems. Okay, that's what he is writing about here. So we're not just looking only for bad things, but this is his expertise. So what else is glaring out there?
The other thing you're seeing a lot of that's kind of worked through the system is the inventory restocking at both the throughout the retail channels and at the consumer level. And what I mean by that is, you know, as you came out of 2008, you know, things were fine going through the summer of 2008. Then everything hit the fan. What happened is a lot of people that would buy, you know, lawn detergent was on sale. Let's buy four bottles of it. And they always had three or four bottles on hand. Well, in 2009, they didn't buy anything because they were scared. They wanted to save their money. Mm-hmm. So you had families that worked down from four bottles of lawn detergent to half a bottle. You saw the retailers in turn cutting back on the number of orders they were placing. So a company like a Procter & Gamble would have seen huge decreases in volume during that period of time. That also backs up into somebody like an International Flavors and Fragrances, that makes things smell nice or taste good. They also make perfume ingredients as well. So what you've seen is a lot of these kind of companies that historically had grown at 1-2%, volume-wise, just kind of population growth, suddenly saw these big negative numbers like -8, -6, and then they started reporting like +12s as these channels all restocked. And you've seen a lot of people start running up names like Procter & Gamble, like Clorox, like IFF, on the idea that, look at all the growth they're posting now. Suddenly they're posting, 10% volume comps and 6% volume comps, for the first time in years. And so everybody's saying, well, we'll be conservative and say this is going to level off at more like 4% growth.
Right.
Well, no, it's going to level off back at 1% growth or zero.
Well, the problem is, don't you agree that a lot of times there's a linear thinking that goes on? So, you know, you have, for example, this growth that you say is, I'm going to say quarter to quarter, it goes from 0 to 5 to 10, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody thinks, okay, 0, 5, 10, well, 15, 20.
There's definitely that, and everybody just looks at the last quarter,
right,
and never steps back and looks at the big picture and says, you know what, compared to where we were 2 years ago, we're still behind,
right,
but we just look really good because we're going against a really awful year,
right,
and so there's a lot of that kind of plays into it too. Yeah,
I did some runs last night on the S&P 500, the index in total, looked at gross margins, operating margins, and profit margin. And obviously you could look at the differences of all of those. And I was looking at the revenues and sales. It looks to me that when we look at where we are today in terms of revenue, we're still lower than we were at the high, obviously. Came back a lot on a quarterly basis. but the expectations are for the next couple of quarters to see a real downtick in revenue. Not comparatively, I'm just talking about a raw downtick in revenue. And then also when we look at the profit margins, I'm not seeing, you know, we're kind of a little bit lower this quarter than we were last quarter on both operating. I don't know which one you would prefer to look at, but operating versus profit margin, gross margin. It would seem that gross margin would be something interesting to look at because that can be, you know, there's less possible playing around that can be done with a variety of different accounting metrics. I mean, what would you use?
I would look at operating margin just to get the full cost picture, but obviously it's a bigger discussion to talk about both, as you talk about operating margin because gross margin is part of that. I mean, what we're seeing is a lot of companies that are still forecasting that their operating margins are going to continue to rise at a pretty good clip, and most of them are basically forecasting, hey, we're going to be at record levels of profitability over the next year. Originally, it was supposed to happen this year, but now they've pushed it out to next year. You know, we're seeing so many games being played at a lot of companies, and that's things like they've redefined depreciation lives. Something they used to depreciate over 10 years, now they're doing it over 15. Suddenly, that's income gains. We're seeing companies that have benefited a lot from FIFO accounting, and this is going to help the gross margin level, where as these commodities have come up in price again, because they're selling what came in the door first at today's replacement cost, they're booking gross margin expansion. And you know, if you look at that compared to a company that's using LIFO accounting, which is last in, first out, they're selling the highest price stuff first, so their margins are still getting squeezed. That's just sort of the cash flow evens this out, but on reported earnings, it tends to help some of these companies.
It's the accounting games.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing we've noticed a lot for some of these companies is they generate a lot of earnings per share growth by buying back shares. And the cash to buy back those shares came from, one, bringing down their working capital levels, which are now rebuilding at higher costs because the inventory levels are higher and they're seeing some more sales, so they're having to rebuild that. And they also cut back on capital spending. So that's having to rise again, and that's going to consume cash. And so you're at this point where, you know, a company, let's say they grew earnings per share at 10%, they might have had 4 or 5% of that just solely from share repurchases. Well, this year they can't afford to buy back any shares.
Well, then on the other hand, let me argue with this with you. One of the most brilliant moves that I've seen, which is just mere pocket-to-pocket finance, is the going out like a Microsoft and going out and funding a dividend or funding a cash buyback, share buyback, excuse me, with very, very low-cost funds. You can get funds at 2%. It's a no-brainer to get $1 billion and to put $1 billion share buyback, or let's call it $750 million, $250 million share dividend out there. It ends up paying for itself, give or take. You get the dividend.
I agree with that to a large degree. I mean, the big reason they're doing it with borrowed funds, though, is that their cash is overseas.
True. But I'm saying it's still a brilliant move, no matter how you want to slice it. At those rates,
I agree with that. At that rate, go ahead and do it.
Even if Microsoft didn't have the cash overseas problem that they brought back would be taxed, etc., the 0.875 they did on that 3-year part, the partial of all the $4 billion that they were offering, is extraordinarily low. And if they can put in a good share buyback and do a dividend, it makes money for everybody, and the cost to carry is ridiculously low.
Certainly, and the interest is has a tax shield on it too. So,
now, how much of a benefit do you see in companies' refinancings? A lot of refinancings coming due because there's natural order of things. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the short-term financing that comes due that really wasn't that high to begin with. But even so, if somebody had a 3-year deal, a debt offering that they had, or in other words, 3 years ago, and that's coming due now, they're getting a great deal. I mean, there's got to be a couple of hundred basis points.
Yeah, if they're a credit-worthy company, it's a great deal for them. And I've seen a lot of companies that are doing refinancings at lower rates or just borrowing the money now and saying, hey, if their debt's not callable, they're just putting the cash on the books and saying, we'll pay the extra 0.75 points for a while, and we'll pay off our debt as it comes due.
Yeah.
It's the problem you have is with companies like REITs and, some of the airlines. companies that inherently have a ton of leverage. And what they've done is they had the sweetheart deals from 2007, 2008. A lot of these companies have the ability to roll debt over or extend their existing payment terms for an extra 12 to 18 months. Those are the companies, they've already done the extension in 2010. So a lot of those companies in 2011 are going to have debt coming due. And the problem they face is the amount of loan to values for their mortgages and things like that, where right. they borrowed this money, let's say at 90% loan to value in 2007 or 2008. Mm-hmm. Well, the property values are lower now than they were then, right. and their rents are down. So, you're looking at deals that are probably at 100 to 120% loan to equity. They're going to have to put more capital up when they roll that debt over in 2011.
The thing is, though, that we're talking about now companies that have, we'll call it collateralized debt of some sort, where that collateralized debt was something that was a value, an object, or whatever it may have been, that has severely depreciated, and particularly that has to be in the real estate sector. So that's definitely a problem. One of the REITs that we talked about, I want to follow up on this, was the REIT that you mentioned last time that had a lot of Blockbusters in their shopping centers, and there was a covenant inside of the lease that talked about how if one of the core tenants were unable to be there and left, that they would get some kind of a benefit to or discount to their leases and what that would mean. How has that played out? And remind us of what company that was.
Yeah, it's Weingarten Realty.
What's the symbol on it?
It's WRI.
Mm-hmm.
There are other companies that do this shopping center type lease that would have a similar arrangement. Essentially, they have what are called power tenants, and a lot of their malls are anchored with a grocery store, and then they might have a secondary power tenant that would be a Blockbuster or a Starbucks, something that generates a lot of traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And the deal is for a lot of their other tenants, and this could be the card shop or the boutique or whatever, their lease might be, let's just say, $20 a foot, which is contingent on there being a grocery store and a Starbucks or a Blockbuster in the mall. If one of those leaves, then it can drop it to, from $20 to $18. Or if you get two of them to leave, it can drop it to $14. So Blockbuster filed bankruptcy, was it last week?
I think it was last week.
Yeah.
Quietly, yeah, okay. very quietly. Nobody cares anymore.
Sure. So you will see more store closings as a result of that. And the problem that these guys are facing is it's not like there's another video store out there to put in here. Everything's sort of gone to the Netflix model of doing it over through the mail or direct downloads from the yep. cable guys or even the little kiosks, the Redbox.
Right.
For like $1 rentals. So that's basically wiping out that power tenant completely. You've already wiped out Circuit Cities over the years. The grocery stores are still consolidating. So you've got a situation where you're going to have this hole of, where do you get this other high volume tenant to come through?
Right.
And as they can't replace that guy, you're going to see a lot of leases start coming down. All these tenants were already negotiating some of that, where they almost every retailer we follow has talked about how they're pushing for rent concessions from landlords. So that pressure is only going to intensify as Blockbuster keeps closing stores.
Well, the problem is that with this, can you short it? I don't know. It really hasn't moved very much. Year to date, it's up about 10%. It has about a 5% dividend on it. So if you're going to go short this stock, the problem is you got to pay the dividend out. So that adds to a problem.
Of the REIT. Yeah.
that's a problem.
I completely agree with that. That's REITs are one of the biggest bubbles out there. The problem is you have to pay the dividend while you short it.
Yeah, and the VIG on that is pretty high on some of these. I mean, this is only a 4.5%. I've seen plenty that are in sevens. So then that means that the VIG you're going to have to pay is 7 and hope for that you get at least 7 back if you have a one-year holding period.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting. All right. Well,
the way to do that is usually with puts. if
right.
You do
yeah, exactly.
Way, then
exactly.
You don't have to pay the dividend.
Right. And that embeds in the VIG, if you will, already. So it's all
right.
Calculated in there. Jeff Middlesmart from BehindTheNumbers.com. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And I will make sure that we put a link. If you want to get a subscription to his service, of course, it's available. And just go to BehindTheNumbers.com. to check out all the things that he's talking about, and I'm sure that you'll find it much, much interest, as I always do. Jeff, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And as I promised you, we have a special guest on as well today. His name is Scott O'Neill, and he's with a group called MarketSmith. Also involved, of course, you know the name. Yes, you do. From his dad. The gentleman, William O'Neill, who has given us the CanSlim methodology, given us Investor's Business Daily, and imparted just incredible amounts of knowledge, not to mention several books on the subject of investing. But the bottom line is that one of the things that they have is tools, many, many tools over at Investor's Business Daily and at Daily Graphs. And now they're kind of, as I understand it, morphing it into MarketSmith, and we're going to get into a discussion of what MarketSmith is, how it's beneficial, and some market issues. So, and I mentioned he's the president of MarketSmith and a portfolio manager. So, Scott, how are you?
Very good. Thank you, Andrew.
So, thanks for joining me. There's so much. This is just rolling out. This is like fresh off the you know, I got an early version beta testing. I was kind of checking out, but this is out. And if for those people out there that don't have any idea what Daily Graphs is all about, can you give me like a quick down and dirty? What, and I keep saying Daily Graphs, I'm talking about the big picture, you know, now MarketSmith, what it's all about.
Yeah, Daily Graphs will be gradually sunsetted in, and everyone will migrate over to MarketSmith. We're in that process now. MarketSmith is a premium equity research tool. It taps our institutional quality database. It has a perfect blend of fundamental and technical data. We have always believed you need both. It has our exclusive ratings and rankings derived from 50 years of experience. It's in an efficient single-view design for quick and effective research. Mm-hmm. The screener is extremely powerful. This is where we put a lot of resources. Anyone can use it regardless of experience. You know, we have professional hedge funds that use the product on down to people that are newer to the markets. It's Mac compatible. That was a big, big request.
Woo-hoo, and finally.
And yeah, Mac and Firefox. Yep. We're hearing that from a lot of people. It also runs on all popular browsers. It's web-based.
Right.
Probably the other two things is that it's very, very flexible, and any investment methodology can be used on MarketSmith. In fact, we have a feature called the Guru Screens, where we have read all the books and materials from a lot of the legends over the last 100 years. Warren Buffett's approach is in there, O'Shaughnessy's approach, Peter Lynch, and of course, Bill O'Neill. And you can pull up a pre-done screen of William O'Neill's approach and screen the entire database and come up with names that he would be looking at, or a Warren Buffett might be considering Ben Graham. Very interesting feature, but that's in a nutshell. It's probably from a bicycle to a Ferrari,
yeah,
from Daily Graphs up to MarketSmith, and it's actually a pretty easy interface, so people aren't overwhelmed. They're very happy. We're getting a lot of good feedback.
Well, let me tell you something. Seriously, there is a lot of depth, first of all, on this, because it becomes one entire research product. And the other thing that's interesting is that one of the things that I always look at at research and data products are two things. Number one is the data scrubbed? You know, where's the data from? Data, if you do the best screen in the world, but the data's crap, the output's going to be just as bad.
You know, Andrew, that's a very astute point. Most people miss that little detail. They think, well, gee, I can go out on the web and get data and this and that. Well, you really have to have truly scrubbed data. We did an analysis of our data, institutional database on U.S. equities against anyone else, all of the other suppliers in this country, and we were at the top.
Yeah.
Now, that was an internal thing, but the cleanliness of data is absolutely critical when you're putting your hard-earned money against that information.
Right. I mean, I could tell you several times, and this happens from time to time, we're looking at data, but somehow there was a miscalculation of something, and, you know, you get a ratio that's really wacky, and that could take an entire position, one stock, out of a screen if you were screening on that particular criteria.
And it could hurt your year.
Right, exactly. That could be something just you wouldn't know about. You say, well, what's the difference? One thing. Well, one thing may be a big issue if it's, number one, incorrectly done, or if there's a lot of things missing from it. So I'm going to try to put a picture. I'm sure you don't mind this. I'm going to do a snapshot of what a couple of snapshots of what this looks like on our website so that people can look at the show notes. But here's some of the things that I like in the charting features that you did new. I think that the checklist is kind of interesting. This is obviously taken from your Investor's Business Daily, where you have that little doctor fellow, and yes. You say, okay, what does he meet? Does he meet EPS growth? Does he meet ROE criteria that we see in our fastest growing companies, et cetera? So what happens is that you give it a checklist against metrics that you would see for winning stocks of the past, right?
Correct.
Okay, so that's great. The other thing that I think is, this is minor, but maybe to you it is. I think it's really cool. Is that you can make notations in there. So you're doing your thing, and you're kind of looking at a chart, and you say, okay, blah, blah, blah. You know, I like what it looks like, but you know what? I'll wait till it does this. So that if you come back 2 weeks later to look at the same chart, your notes are there. And that's great.
Yes. This, Andrew, this is an absolutely critical piece. You know, nobody likes to do a post-analysis. In other words, review all your trades for the year somewhere at the end of the year, early next year, to look for what you did right and what you did wrong.
Right.
There's a tremendous amount that you can learn by just reviewing your operations. And what happens is when you get to the end of the year, you forget two-thirds of everything you were dealing with in the live battlefield.
Right.
So you go over to notes and you put notes in right there. On, you know, you're looking at Apple. By the way, I have a position in Apple. You're looking at the Apple chart, and you jot down notes, why you added to the position, or why you lightened up in a difficult day, sort of thing. And then, in the longer term, you look back and you say, were these decisions right? It's incredibly valuable, and I know it's a little like watching paint dry, but in reality, it's an incredible exercise.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's also news on this now, which is great. At least you could find out what's moving something as you're looking for a stock. The sector tracking. What's the psychological indicators? What are you looking at there? Because I didn't actually look at that when I was. I'm only partly through all the different new features, to be honest with you. What's the psychological indicators that you have?
Well, on those, as we know, the stock market is just this giant ball of psychology. And there are these contrarian points in the market where, if you're looking at those, they might help you a little bit. They are secondary indicators. You know, remember, you go back to the chart, price and volume, that's number one, regardless of everything you're hearing or reading, et cetera. But at certain times, we will defer to some of those and just pull them up and look at them. For instance, September 1, when we had a follow-through day, mm-hmm. this September, the psychology was extremely negative because, right. Let's face it, it's been a pretty tough summer, right?
Yep.
And on top of that, you're hearing everywhere you turn that September's the worst month of the year, and it you always get hurt, so sell and go away kind of thing.
Yep.
And meanwhile, price and volume said, no, we're going to be strong this year. So then, 2 weeks into the market, and 2 weeks into that follow-through, I'm hearing, well, this is the best September since 1939. And I'm going, oh, great. So you got to be careful with those, but they do help a little bit at key turning points.
Yeah. Well, you know, you look at the AAII investor bullish bearish, it's almost exactly when they get overly bullish that things start turning around, and overly bearish things turn around, which is kind of interesting. Let me back up for a second to the guru screens, because I did look at the William O'Neill screen, and I was wondering, because there was a lot of stocks, you know, you have your secret recipe for your IBD 100, but there was a lot of stocks in the IBD 100 that were on that too. It's a similar screen to find stocks that will perform, but it's not the exact screen that you would use for the IBD 100, right?
Yes. It's slightly different, but it's pretty close.
Okay.
We have a product coming out in maybe another 6 weeks we call Growth 250, where we have 28 screens, and it is sort of in the flavor of the IBD 100, but it's kind of interesting. It's an accordion. In a lousy market environment, it becomes a wafer, and right now it's been expanding,
right.
And we have a ceiling of 350 stocks. So we're kind of taking what my father's done just a little bit further, and that's black boxes also. It's proprietary screens, but the book is fabulous.
Right. So the one of the things that I find interesting is that, you know, obviously Investor's Business Daily can be very powerful. You start, you know, you get into that IBD 100, you get your little black box around you and all that. And a lot of people will just buy that because they want to take the easy way and all. But at the same time, I think that this product, I really do believe this. And seriously, I believe that, you know, I'm not getting paid for this, gang. You know me, is a great. First of all, Daily Graphs Online was great, but this is a great way to look at it. The only, like, let me give you a couple things that I may, if you could scratch a few things down that I have some comments on.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the printing on Daily Graphs Online was better than the printing on MarketSmith.
Yes, that's in the works and will be improved. Yes,
okay.
We're aware of that one.
Okay, good. The second thing is that I really would like to see a much more robust annotations bar. Let me tell you what I mean by that. You know, obviously, we're not talking about, you know, you can get into a lot of different very high-end technical analysis, the Fibonacci's and retracements, and you can get into all sorts of fun things. There's a couple of things I have no idea what the use is for, like that little, is it supposed to be for a cup, that little half moon thing in there? What does that do? You have a little curvy line thing that doesn't, you can't really make a cup out of it anyway.
Okay, where are we?
In the annotations is there's a little, I don't know what it would be. It'd be a little cup looking thing.
The little curvy question mark?
No, it's a little curvy.
Oh, going down.
Yeah.
Markups, the cast. Sometimes someone will like to look at underneath a cup and or as a stock's going out. How much it pulls back in relation. I got to be honest. I don't use that.
Yeah, no kidding.
There are those.
No
yeah,
kidding.
Yeah, no, there are those that will use that. you know, can I shift gears? I got something interesting.
Yep.
It is very easy to make investing complicated. You have to fight and work hard at simplicity in general. That's why MarketSmith, It's on a single view. It's in a single view design format. We consolidate everything down for everyone. They're not going out looking for additional pieces of information and whatnot. It's all right here. And you really want to try to stay focused on whatever your investment approach is and stay pure to it, because sometimes you can get lured away. Now, I actually had one of our coaches explain that to me. Now I understand what you mean. I've never used it.
Right. All I'm saying is this. I'm not saying get more complicated with things, but, for example, get more robust with the features. So when I draw a line, just draw a line, simple line. You know, take that line tool and just draw a line.
Mm-hmm.
So it's there, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't do anything with it after you draw it. It's done. It's dead. The line is dead. Now, say I didn't draw it correctly. Let's say that I want to expand it and draw it longer. Leave it on the chart and draw it longer. I said, okay, you know what? I'm going to move it from this point to this point. I want to see what that looks like. Now, you can draw a new line, of course.
Right.
You know, but I wanted to say, oh, I'd like to take the end and kind of move it. So that line becomes like a permanent line once you put, not permanent because you could delete it, but permanent as in that's where the line is going. That's the end of the sentence. It would be nice to make that line or whether it's diagonal or, you know, whatever the tools that we're using there. Arrows, for example, those things would be nice to put on there. So you can put notes underneath an arrow and make that when I do notes, for example. I don't know if the notes can be annotated after I've done them.
Well, the line, we don't really want to tweak it. You can take a snapshot and keep it. The annotations, you can move little marks along. Where we're going is we want to make this very effective for post-analysis mark.
Right.
Okay, I bought 100 shares here and why, and 100 shares here I added and why. But the line pen, it's pretty fixed. more for the way we're looking at trends and undercuts and breakouts and that kind of thing.
I hear you. Yeah. I just, you know, I'm just used to using a line that I can sometimes move around on a screen if I want to for different reasons and all that. But, you know, it's interesting in a couple of Bill O'Neill's books, he has old charts that he had. I love this, where he had all these writings on the charts.
Yeah, I know.
That was really
cool.
Those
are neat.
Where it's actually were snapshots of these of all the writing that's done, the post analysis or the analysis as it's happening, which is kind of interesting because so many times, you know, you talk about and Kate talks about this whole idea of a watch list. You know, getting prepared with your watch list because sometimes, you know, a watch list can grow very large, for example, or it could be very lean. I know there was a time under Ken Slim if you were looking at doing a true Ken Slim approach. And I even know the guys who, I guess they were doing the Ken Slim stocks over at whatever that is, Northern something or other. There was like the time there was no stocks in the that were meeting criteria.
Yes, and that tells you something about your environment.
Right, exactly. I mean, your earnings weren't there or, you know, usually it was earnings issues, revenues issues, and sales issues were there, obviously. It tells you that things are starting to slow down, et cetera, and there's very, very few things. So instead of forcing yourself into a position, you have to say, you know, hey, I don't want to get in there and do that. So tell me about, you know, the whole idea of this sharing. So how does that work? You could share charts, you could share watch lists. Who are you sharing with?
I'm glad you asked that. That's another very unique new feature, community. You know, a lot of people expect community now. Ours is a closed community, so it's within the Market Smith universe, and typically it's more seasoned investors comparing notes, comparing lists, comparing screenshots, analyzing a chart. It's kind of like a university. Some of the comments I've seen are pretty astute.
So do you have your coaches involved in there too? Or is it just, person to person and,
It's person to person. The coaches are really just to make sure that the spirit of it remains at a good high professional level.
Right. So in other words, the guy that wants to short something isn't going to be not only fighting with the guy that wants to long something, but they don't get into fisticuffs about and start bringing all sorts of parents involved and things that they've done there. That's kind of neat. This is really, honestly, Scott, this is obviously took you a lot of time to do. It's very impressive. What is the starting point in terms of how the cost factors for someone to do this?
Well, it's $999 a year for an annual subscription to the service, and you can go to marketsmith.com, marketsmith.com, or give us a call. You know, we all love stocks here too. Everyone out there, you know, they're doing things. 800-452-4422.
And I think this, unless this is just for me, but maybe it's just for Daily Graphs Online customers, there's a 30-day free. Is that you get a trial at all?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I forgot that. There's a two-week trial. I think it's $20, and they credit you. Or there's a three-day free, I call it a peak, but a trial.
You can get a good amount of information in 3 days. I mean, if you really want to do it, you know, because it will give you a lot of great information, you know, into that period of time. I think that's kind of cool. It's beginning September 15th through October 15th. You have unlimited access. All right, that's for people. Now, here's a question. So Daily Graphs Online. If you're a Daily Graphs Online user, I know that my subscription carries right over, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Except you have to call us, and we'll help you move across.
Of the things I've saved already.
Yeah, there are a few steps, and so please call us at 800-452-4422, and we can assist you. Definitely, most of the DGO people, once they see Market Smith and we're playing with it like you in beta, they've been coming across. We're on the phones quite a bit right now.
I better do something, because actually, I didn't know how to actually call and figure that out. You know what's really cool? I'm sorry, I've told you the bad stuff about the charting that I didn't like, so now I'm going to tell you about something really cool. In the past, when we create a list from wherever we're creating our list from, okay? So we have a list of, I'm just saying, 20 stocks, right? Either typing them in one at a time, which is a real drag, Or you would use an Excel spreadsheet, transfer it into TXT, and then upload it, right? You know what I'm talking about, the import feature. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, now you just copy, you just put in Excel, for example, down on one column, you copy it, you know, Control C, you go over to the new list that you created, or the watch list, I guess what you're calling it, you just Control V, and it just takes a few seconds, and bang, there it is. And you can put in your own columns, which is really nice, so you can then, you know, look at the different functions of the, you know, what it is, whether you want to look at industry sector, subsector, you want to look at, you know, earnings per share, growth, et cetera, whatever it is, your various ratings, whether it's, you know, something that's in an accumulation phase or whatever. Very, very cool stuff.
Yeah, Andrew, simplicity is critical. We actually used a little bit of Apple's approach with intuitive drag and drop. And then also, nobody has time. The tool has got to be efficient and right. save multiple steps and channel all that information down into a usable format. And we spent 3 years in design and development on this product with an army of technologists plus of quite expensive outside consulting group too, to get to exactly what you just said. Fast, efficient, clean. You can drop a list in, go through it, sort it, segregate it any which way you want with any investment approach that you want.
Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff.
Yes.
So just as we go, I want to mention that I thought it was really neat how, it's funny actually, so you have the Market Smith, the next generation of daily graphs online. There's a little flyer. It gives you kind of a cheat sheet of what's on here. But it says, you know, Market Smith will give you these things and blah, 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 blah. And then it says connect across almost all browsers and runs on both the Apple Mac OS X and Microsoft Windows platform. I thought that was hysterical that Apple was first, because you just never see that in the investment world. You never see Apple. You know, but
yeah, but you haven't you haven't collected all our phone calls for the last 5 years.
All right,
how
right,
come
right.
you're not Mac compatible?
Yeah, well, then you got and you got away from the ActiveX, which is a real problem anyway on the,
yeah.
on the PC platform in terms of you know, vulnerability. So that's good. No, it's really great, because I've been one of the people on the phone going, "Hey, what's going on?" Again, whether it's Mac or PC, the fact that it could work on Firefox, for example, for me is my preference, so that it works across both. So that's great. I really do encourage everybody. I'm going to put some links on there, and I know you have some also some coaching available. That's another part of what you do. As a matter of fact, I just finished a podcast for The Winning Investor all about mentors and financial mentors. So that's probably a good discussion. It's important sometimes to have a coach help you out, you know, with what's going on, how to use it, maybe the workflow. So that's it's really great that you're offering that, and you know, I want to thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll talk soon.
Thank you, Andrew. Take care.
All right, have a great day. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Well, that was chock full of good information, wasn't it? I love that. That was I think this podcast was great. I think this episode was great, and I really enjoyed both of our guests today. And I do encourage you to check out, again, they're not sponsoring us or anything like that, but I do encourage you to check out a lot of the tools that are available on this new Market Smith. Go take advantage of the freebie that they give out. We'll put those links and some pictures. I got some pictures on the show notes so you can see kind of what it looks like in one of the chart pages and the screens and things like that. We are going to actually have a great guest, as I mentioned, Mr. Tom McClellan. He'll be on next week. A lot of questions are going to be answered. And then we're going to follow up through the end of the year. We're going to change it up a little bit. We're going to actually go and try to start giving you some further ideas in terms of some positions, some areas to go into. We've been talking about a lot of economics. We're going to switch over to more stock-based things each episode. One of the things I do want to mention to you is, if you want to take a quick peek at some of the stocks that we've been looking at and that actually own and we've recommended, over at DH Unplugged, each and every week we talk about stocks. At the end of the show, we talk about, hey, what looks good over the next little while for maybe a trade and something to look at. And we have a list of those on a live Google spreadsheet. And the reason why I say live is that it actually records the information that you have, and it updates on a regular, like instantaneous basis from the Google Finance website. So in other words, we created a website, a worksheet through Google Docs that has a symbol, the price we bought it at, let's say, and we put the current value. Well, we could do some mathematics behind that and show how much it's up, how much it's down. But beyond that, for example, it will fill out automatically through what they call mnemonics, the name of the stock. Maybe you want the EPS. Maybe you want to know a little bit more about the actual company itself, financials, etc. That's all could be automated through this Google thing. If you haven't seen it, do yourself a favor. Go over to DH Unplugged for a quick second. Go to any of the episodes. In the bottom, it says weekly spreadsheet or weekly tracking spreadsheet, stock tracking spreadsheet, something like that, and click on it. Just look at it. See what the things that can actually happen. That is, aside from we put the symbol in, most of that calculates automatically all the way across. We put the symbol and the cost and everything else calculates. Kind of cool, huh? Even when we put short or long, we've actually made it so we can do an if-then in there. So these are the kind of really neat tools you can use to track a portfolio. Or if you want, if you haven't thought of it, maybe track a sample portfolio. Maybe say, hey, here's an aggressive ideas I have. Here's my short ideas I have. This is the long ideas I have in terms of some great long-term plays here. Here's where I want to buy it, et cetera. And you can track what you're doing and at least keep it in the tabs below and then have it actively update. You know, just a freebie from Google. All right, we'll talk to you next week. I hope you enjoyed. If you have any questions, of course, email them to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Until next week, I hope that you have a very enjoyable week, a very profitable week. And if you want to watch that video on how we invest in all that, just go over to the website. If you're looking for an investment advisor, that's what we're here for. Check it out. 14-minute video that shows you basically a virtual tour of what we do. All right, we're going to leave it at that. Have a great week. Have a tremendous amount of success. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye for now.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.